For African peoples, nothing important happens without a libation. And so for this very important presentation, we begin by the pouring of libation. We pour libation first to our first ancestor, to that hidden one who, though hidden, manifests in all things as all things, that God-goddess idea in the universe by any and all names. To our first ancestor, we pour libation, Ashe. We pour libation, too, to our ancestors because they were the first people on this planet, mothers and fathers of all mankind, flashpoint of the human family. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation, too, to our ancestors because they were the ones who first gave birth to the idea of civilization, knew we would need a form of governance, and they nurtured that idea along the Nile until it reached its zenith in Kemet. There they built these gigantic monuments as evidence of that great civilization, and they carved instructions on the walls of temples and tombs for us so we would never forget. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation, too, to our ancestors because over time they put together all the tenets of civilization and they took those ideas and left the continent. They were the people of the first Exodus. They left Africa and went all over the world and peopled the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. We pour libation, too, to our ancestors because they did not sit on their laurels. They continued to improve, continued to evolve, and at each point of evolution, they again would leave the continent and settle and resettle the planet. They met themselves coming and going. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation, too, to those ancestors because over time, they found themselves the object of a forced exodus. When they were kidnapped, shackled, cargoed, shipped out of Africa and enslaved in diasporas around the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation, too, to the ancestors left at home, the very young, the aged, the infirm, left to reinvent themselves, depleted of us, human resources. But they were enjoined by us in the diasporas, both objects of a global myopia that ruptured the soul of a people as it ravaged a continent. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation, too, to those ancestors because over time they began to remember who and what they were. Because no matter where they had been dropped off, they still retained bits and pieces of who and what they were. They retained that African core that described them. They began to remember bits and pieces of a song. They began to remember lines from a rhythm. They began to remember dances that they did in ancient times. They began to remember those ancient drum beats that they now beat out on bare skin. And so to those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation, too, to them because they then began to teach each other. They began to resurrect and reconstruct that history and that culture. They became the new Africans wherever they were. They became the new teachers, preachers, archaeologists, the new singers, dancers, the new drummers, the new Jalia. They reconstructed that history and our culture and became new Africans everywhere. So to those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation to those ancestors because they are the ones who passed that information on to us. And so we pour libation to those of you who will watch this presentation, those of you who are the recipients of that pieced together history, of that reconstructed culture. To you, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation, too, to our children and those yet to be born. For they are the ones that you must teach. And you can only teach if you know the history. So to you who are learning the history and are passing on that history, and to our children who are learning that history and will pass that history on to all eternity, for they will call your name in all eternity. To our children, we pour libation. Ashe. Ashe. Asheo.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. the relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Hotep and greetings, my sisters and brothers. Welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. I am your host, William Rogers. We thank you so much for joining us here this Tuesday evening. As you know, we are here every Tuesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. Central Time, 8 to 10 Eastern, and so forth with the other time zones as well. But we're so happy that you are here to join us. We have a dynamic discussion that we must always continuously talk about and make sure that we are working towards some end to get rid of this ugly system. Tonight we are talking about the emasculation of the black male and the carceral system in America. Yesterday, today, and hopefully we're not safe tomorrow. And that's what we are here to do tonight. And as I said, you know, this is a conversation that we must continue to have. We cannot afford to not talk about this. There's too many of our brothers, our fathers, our husbands, and our brothers in the community. There's just entirely too many of them that are wrapped up in the system. So we must continue to work on solutions. Look at the fact there was a community forum and find ways to try to address this very, 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 very ugly system. And let me say something about solutions when we talk about that. First of all, this is a think tank format. This is what we've been doing here now for some time. And in a think tank format, we're not always guaranteed to come out and present something that's going to change tomorrow. Changes are not made that way. They weren't done overnight. They were done over time. And they were layered and layered and layered and layered in terms of building. So what we must do now is to deconstruct that. You must do it layer by layer by layer. And so obviously in order for that to take place, we then must very well continuously talk about it. It is never a point where you don't want to talk about this no more. I'm tired of talking about that. Nothing's going to happen. Something can happen, and we will try to continue to do that. So here at the Black Reality Think Tank, we have a group of brilliant community-minded brothers and sisters, people who are dedicated and loyal to their people and who love their people. And that's why I'm so happy to be here with you every Tuesday night doing that. And very clearly, what we're talking about tonight is a major, major, major problem. And so that's why we have to address this in any way we can. And what we are doing is we are working toward ideas that will produce solutions. That's the goal. I know a lot of folks say, well, I don't want to talk about all that. What's, you talk about the problem. What's the solution? Well, you can't. Solution can't be done in that way for anything. I don't care what it is in life and nature. It has to take that. So this is what we are doing, and this is why we're here tonight. And as you know, always, we are going to do an ancestral profile. I always do that to honor our ancestors. You know, we often say we stand on the shoulders of greatness. The great Brandon Lou Hamer said, we'll always praise the bridges that brought us over. And so we must do that. And tonight, I want to talk about a brother. I just love this man. And I wish we had more of him. And if we had more of these kind of brothers around, we would not have some of the challenges we have with this carceral system. And tonight, I want to talk about a beautiful brother, a brother by the name of Judge Bruce Wright. Judge Bruce Wright. Judge Wright was born in Baltimore, Maryland. He was raised in Princeton, New Jersey, and he spent the majority of his adult life living in Harlem, New York. In 1939, Judge Wright was awarded a scholarship to attend Princeton University, but he was denied admission. When he arrived, and the dean of admissions, Radcliffe Hermes, learned that he was black. Wright was denied admission to Notre Dame on the same grounds. He studied at Virginia Union University and graduated from Lincoln University in 1942. Wright then served in a U.S. Army segregated medical unit during World War II. He volunteered for combat duty and was assigned to Company K, 16th Infantry Regiment. And after the war, he went AWOL, making his way to Paris, where he was befriended by Senegalese poet Léopold Senghor, who later became his country's first president. Wright's early ambition was to become a poet, and he was introduced and later became a very good friend to a well-known brother by the name of Langston Hughes. Wright's first book of poetry was called From the Shaken Tower. From the Shaken Tower. And it was edited by Hughes and published in 1944. He studied at Fordham University Law School and obtained his law degree from New York Law School. New York City Mayor John B. Lindsay appointed Wright as the general counsel for the New York City Human Resources Administration in 1967 and named him to the New York City criminal court bench in 1970. Judge Wright was soon publicly critical of the justice system and the whole judiciary process, and he voiced his belief that race and class all too frequently determine the outcomes of trials. He denounced what he called racism in the criminal justice system, and he created a furor by often setting very low bail and sometimes no bail at all for poor or minority suspects. In one case in which bail of $100,000 was requested by the Manhattan District Attorney's Office for Joseph Gutola, who had been accused of shooting a police officer, Judge Wright set the bail at $500. After Gutola posted bail and was released the same day, another judge revoked it and ordered him rearrested. When Gutola was brought into court the next day, Wright again set the bail at $500. Gutola was eventually acquitted of attempted murder, but convicted of assault and robbery. In another case involving a man named Seymour Popkin, who had been charged with the beating of another man to death in a fist fight in Times Square, Judge Wright released him on his own recognizance after an assistant district attorney declined to release the name of a potential witness, despite Popkin's criminal record extending back 20 years. The charge was eventually reduced to simple assault, and Popkin was acquitted at trial. Wright was given the nickname Turn 'em Loose Bruce by the Police Officers Union in New York City because of his bail practices. And this was repeated often in the New York newspapers. They called him Cut Him Loose Bruce. After continued protest by the Police Officers Union, Wright was transferred to New York City Civil Court in 1974 by David Ross, the city's administrative judge, who said it was just part of the usual rotation of judges and denied that the move had anything to do with his bail policies. Judge Wright then sued in federal court, seeking reinstatement. But in 1978, as hearings on his long-delayed lawsuit were brought to begin, he was transferred back to the criminal court. The controversy promptly resumed, with the Transit Police Union making their first complaint about Judge Wright a week after he returned to the criminal court bench. It peaked in April of 1979, when Jerome Singleton was charged with slashing the throat of a white decoy police officer, whose name was Robert Bilodeau. After bail had initially been set at $10,000 cash by another judge, Judge Wright released Singleton in his own recognizance, saying that he had no previous criminal record, a strong family and community ties, and that prosecutors had offered no convincing reason to bar Singleton's release. Singleton eventually was found guilty of second-degree assault and acquitted of first-degree assault and attempted murder. However, while some criticized Wright, others thought he was fair. Despite his outspoken views and practices, Wright was elected to the New York State Supreme Court in 1979. Throughout his career, Wright held on to his belief that the judicial system, including bail, was stacked against poor and minority defendants. in a lecture at Columbia University Law School in 1979. He said that a more appropriate name for him would have been Civil Right instead of Cut 'Em Loose Bruce Right. He retired on December 31st, 1994. Several days before his retirement, he said, "I have never changed my mind about the Eighth Amendment. To say that I would have done things differently means to me I would have been a good boy, kept my mouth shut, and availed myself of the benefits of the system. I don't think I can do that. I don't think I could ever do that." Judge Wright spent 25 years on the bench hearing criminal and civil cases and had a reputation as a scholarly and provocative jurist who sprinkled the opinions with literary quotations. He was the author of a 1987 book, and if any of you brothers and sisters haven't read it, I would suggest that you do, because it is a powerful piece of writing. The name of the book is Black Robes, White Justice. Black Robes, White Justice. It's about the role of race in the judicial system. And it won a 1991 American Book Award. He later authored an autobiography called Black Justice in a White World. Black Justice in a White World. 65 years after being denied admission because of his race, the Princeton class of 2001 made him an honorary member of their class. In retirement, Judge Wright worked as a greeter at the local old Saybrook Walmart. He explained this by saying he needed to supplement his retirement income in order to visit Italy, which he loved doing. Judge Wright died in his sleep on March 24, 2005, at his home in Old Saybrook, Connecticut, at the age of 87. Bruce Cut 'Em Loose Wright, my kind of man. I'm so happy to hear it. I had the pleasure of meeting him. That was my days out. It was in New York, and I had a privilege of meeting Judge Wright at a Christmas party. And wonderful guy to talk to, beautiful brother. He was a hero to all black folk in Harlem. Everybody loved Bruce Wright, but obviously the New York City Police Department and the union, at least the youth union, and some of the others detested him tremendously. But we need more Bruce Wrights today to have an understanding of what this judicial system is about. So tonight we're going to talk a little bit. This is our format. I want to talk a little bit. I'm going to just do a little brief commentary about this prison system. I want to break down some information about the prison structure. As you know, we talked about it in the topic. We talked about looking at this system of emasculating black men. It's a carceral system that has been in place for a long time. It has been in the past, the present, and pray God that it won't be the future. But we need, it's up to us, though, to make sure that that doesn't happen. So tonight we want to talk a little bit about it. I think one of the foundations of understanding the carceral system, the prison system, the penal institutions of America, particularly as it relates to black folk, is best looked at in a book by one of our ancestors. His name was Dr. Amos Wilson. He wrote a book called The Falsification of African Consciousness, The Eurocentric History, Psychiatry, and the Politics of White Supremacy. And I think the foundation of why the penal system was created and why it is what it is comes from that wisdom of Brother Amos Wilson. And this is what he said. He said, "The role of Eurocentric history writing plays in rationalizing European oppression of African peoples and in the falsification of African consciousness, and contend that the alleged mental and behavioral maladaptiveness of oppressed African people is a political economic necessity for the maintenance of white domination and imperialism." And let me just read that last part once again. He said, he alleges that it's the mental and behavior maladaptiveness of oppressed African peoples is a political, economic necessity for the maintenance of white domination and imperialism. I had to think about that a little bit over time, and I looked at it and I said, you know, he hit the nail right on the head. Because when I think about it, I worked in the criminal justice system for about 15 years. And when you think about it, can you imagine that if people today would say, oh, well, there's no more, we're going to get rid of crime, nobody's going to commit any crime anymore, there's a reduction in how we're going to process people going through, if anything happens, how we're going to do it. You know how many people will be unemployed? You know how much money that the city of New York would lose? You know how much money that would be lost in Chicago, Milwaukee, California, L.A., San Francisco, if the criminal justice system was to be placed under arrest, and it would have to operate on a whole different frame, or even if people didn't commit crime anymore? Can you imagine what that would be like? How much money would be lost? I once had a tracked how much money, this was back a while ago, so now I'm sure now it's triple, how much money comes through the criminal court system of Wisconsin on a given day, I mean Milwaukee, but on a given day, how much money in terms of fines and tickets and, you know, all that little petty mess they, you know, would charge you, jaywalking and all of that. And how much it was. Now, this was around 1992, 93. And actually, I was doing it for my class. I wanted my class to understand the criminal system. And the amount, based on the estimation that I got, was $150,000 a day. Fines, petty stuff, late fees, tickets, and on and on. And then, how many lawyers would lose their job? Wisconsin is a state, is a very interesting state. It has the largest amount of black men arrested than any state in the union. There are more black men in prison in the state of Wisconsin than it is in California, New York, where you have large populations of people. And so the question becomes, why? What makes that? But anyway, think about the attorneys that who are working, those attorneys who have handling legal aid, because most of them work through the legal aid system. What about the judges, the clerks, and all of those different people, which is a part of that economic system called the court system? How much money would be lost if they did? How many people would be unemployed, and all the attorneys and the judges? And that kind of gives you an idea of the economics of this system, which is what Dr. Wilson said. He's saying that it is a political economic necessity. So in order to make sure that that money keeps coming in, make sure that money is being turned out in the way that it is, you've got to keep the pressure on making sure that the people who will make are causing that money to happen, continue to suffer under that power, under that system. And so black folk, which we're talking about, may get a ticket for jaywalking. And you got some young 18-year-old boy who doesn't have a job, he gets a ticket, $50 ticket for jaywalking. He can't pay that ticket. He doesn't have the money right now. I mean, he doesn't pay it because he thinks it's insignificant. And as a result, the ticket bills, it becomes a warrant. And then you're up to $400 or $500 in order for him to get his freedom. And I think that's where we have to begin at looking at the economics. Like we always say, you got to follow the money trail. You got to look at the economics of incarceration. There's a lot of money in that system. Even to the point, as we know, the private prison systems were operating on the stock exchange. You could buy stocks, you know, in a lot of those private prison systems that were being created, you know, in order to sort of take the, and the burden that it was taking off of the state wasn't necessarily an economic burden, more as it was the pressure of having to try to maintain that in certain places and at certain times. There are cities, for instance, right here in Wisconsin, because of that large number of people we're talking about, there are cities whose whole economy is based on the prison that is placed there. there's a city up near the Wisconsin Dells in Wisconsin, which is sort of northwest up by Madison, the capital, called Oxford, Wisconsin. Oxford, Wisconsin is the home of the federal penitentiary that's up there, Oxford Prison, Oxford Federal Prison. And that entire town operates off of that prison. Most of the people that work there are part of the prison system. The restaurants, hotels, motels, stores, all make that money from that population of people that come up there to visit their relatives and have to have somewhere to stay. And as you know, in a federal prison system, a lot of the inmates that are there are not even from Wisconsin. So there are people that come from New York, people might come from California, might come from Wyoming, Texas, come to Oxford to visit their relatives, their fathers, their brothers, their uncles, whoever, and will have to stay in Oxford. And so Oxford makes its money, its economy from that. And there's so a lot of them. There's another one in called Boscobel, Boscobel, Wisconsin. Boscobel is the home of the Supermax prison, where you're confined for something like 22 hours, and you get a 1 hour to come out of your pen each day, and walk around, go out into the court, and then you have to go back into complete lockdown. That's Boscobel Prison. Look them up. You know, take a look at Boscobel. That whole town operates off of Boscobel and how it does. And so anyway, I wanted to talk about, as we introduced, the economics of that. And then when we open up our lines to talk about it, maybe you all can share some of the things that you know from your states. We got several states that are represented here. You can share with us some of those horror stories that you've heard from there. But anyway, that money is important. But along with that money, we have to also look at this continuous police brutality system that we see operating in our community. And so a lot of the recent protests following the murder of George Floyd, it has brought a lot of attention to this crisis, and it looks at, because it feeds right into the mass incarceration system. According to an organization that operates called the Prison Policy Initiative, 2.3 million people, 2.3 million people, 2.3 million people are incarcerated in the United States. It is the number one country of incarcerated individuals in America. I'm sorry, in America, in the world. I didn't mean the world. I mean in the world. 2.3 million. 20% of the world's prison population is right here in America. They are incarcerated in the United States. And while black people, African people, our brothers and sisters, make up only 13% of that, they are 40% of the prisoners of that number that we talked there, 40% of that 2.3, yet they are only 13% of the population of the United States. Now you do the math and tell me where the horror is. Millions more are on probation or parole. They are facing restrictions on housing, employment, and in many states, even their right to vote. They have been stripped of everything. And so like the police violence against people of color, it really isn't a new issue. And I'm not telling you something that's new. You know this has been going on for a while. But there have been activists like Angela Davis and Ruth Wilson Gilmore who have been arguing for the abolition of prisons for decades. They're talking, just like they were talking about the abolition of slavery, they want the abolition of the penal justice system to occur. Just like that. So they've been recommending, and they have been speaking with lawyers and activists and coming together and writing books and trying to just show the ugliness of all of that. The recent film by Ava called 13th Amendment that had been showing. The book by, the book on the mass industrial complex system, by the system. It's the same thing that has been pushed around and people talking about this and trying to find a way to deconstruct this other way. But since mass incarceration is entangled with economics, the issues of race, gender, sexuality, and global economics, the best way to handle it is you have to seek out the experts and get their perspectives on the topic. We have to bring together community forums like we're doing here tonight. This is the Black Reality Think is a community forum. And we want to talk about and address that so you can go to whatever areas of your community, whatever work you do, and bring this to the table. And there are some wonderful resources. I'm just going to name a few that you can use in doing that. There's a book by a guy named Jeffrey Adler. He is a professor. He wrote a book called Murder in New Orleans, The Creation of Jim Crow Policing. And then there's a guy named Paul Butler. He's a law professor. He wrote a book called Chokehold, Policing Black Men. And these are publications that are bringing out in plain daylight, you know, what is taking place. And you ask yourself, how long does this keep on? We've done that here on the Black Reality. How long is this police thing going to kill? How long are they going to keep killing our men? Well, as long as you got that mass incarceration system, as long as you got this this economic structure that has been built, as Amos Wilson says, for the maintenance of white domination imperialism. That's how long it's going to keep going on. But these are good books to look at. There's another one that I thought I might just want to mention. It's a book by Sarah Haley. She wrote a book called No Mercy Here, Gender, Punishment, and the Making of Jim Crow Modernity. And a book by Elizabeth Hinton, professor and author, From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime, The Making of Mass Incarceration in America. Jen Mannion, another professor, wrote a book called Liberty's Prisoners, Carceral Culture in Early America. And so these are things that we need that will expose this system, and there are opportunities for us to do something, but we need to have our facts, and we need to be able to approach power like Frederick Douglass said. We must make demand on power. It has to be done. So America's 400-year history of racial injustice still continues to produce profound economic inequalities, and that's the heart of all of this, is the inequalities that come from having a father of three children in prison for 10 years while a mother tries to feed them. Those are some serious inequalities. And he's in prison because of something that he really did not do. Or maybe he could have been looked at a different way, but he couldn't afford the legal support to help. So you've got this disparity. You've got this inequality going on. You've got children that are running around who now have begun to become used to their fathers not being home because they're in prison. Over the years, I used to work with the elementary school with young kids, working with young boys, mentoring young boys. And I would sometimes ask, how many of your fathers live with you? That was one of the questions I asked most of them. And the school that I was working in, about 95% said their fathers didn't live with them. I can only remember maybe once or twice where you might have gotten something higher than 3% or 4% of the class said that their fathers did live with them. And so I would say then, well, where is your father? Do you know? And very forcefully, with no apprehension whatsoever, most of them would say, well, my daddy in jail. And the other kids would laugh, you know, back in my day, coming up, if you said that, they'd laugh at you. But these kids didn't laugh. They said, my daddy in jail. And so I didn't push it anymore. I said, what about anybody else? The other said, mine in jail too. He raised his hand. And then I remember this one class, I never forget it. This guy said, my daddy in jail too, and my mama too. So I said, well, who do you live with? I live with my grandma. Or I live with my aunt. Those kinds of things. And that's a horror system. Because many grandmothers and aunts are like 35, 40 years old, 45 years old, 50 years old. And they may be working, you know, very menial jobs. They may even have children of their own. But their sister got arrested. And the husband was not there, so they take the kids to keep them from going into the system. and foster care. And you know the horror of foster care. And so as a result of that, they now have to struggle trying to raise kids, and they can't go get benefits. If you take on your sister's kids, you can't go and get some kind of benefit or aid for them under your name. You have to qualify yourself to be a part of that, which means if you work or had some other things, you're just going to have to try to find another way to pay for taking care of your kids or those kids. I mean, I know families like that. I'm not just talking about a textbook thing. I know families that are suffering out of that system. And so those are the kind of things we don't really see right now. And see, with the net worth of income of black families, that's catastrophic. That's a shocking, catastrophic thing. Black men and women are also jailed at more than triple. Please hear me, brothers and sisters. Black men and women are also jailed at more than triple the rate of white men and women. And nearly half of all people serving effective life sentences are black. Nearly half. Desperate enforcement is one reason for the example. The majority of the people that stopped in New York City's controversial Stop and Frisk program were black. That's under Mayor Giuliani when they started enforcing that first strongly. They were African American people. Perhaps more disturbingly, black men and women are far more likely to be the victims of the police use of force. So on top of being arrested, they also gonna get beat up and shot, and sometimes hurt in very bad ways. So the protests that erupted in the spring of 2020 and others, catalyzed by Black Lives Matter movement, revealed and reinforced a growing public understanding of these systematic racial disparities in the criminal justice system. Somebody has got to raise their voice. And like I said, a lot of times I've been around my friends and buddies, and they criticizing Black Lives Matter and talking about this and that. Man, please, somebody's got to get out there hollering and screaming and do something to raise attention and get some change moving in these matters. They have to. What we're saying is that this system has been going on for a long time. Now, let me just briefly, I'm a historian, so I can't talk without talk a little bit about history. Let's kind of look at, I just wanted to kind of give you a brief look at the history of incarceration and the history of prisons, so that you can put all of this in perspective along with America. Now, first of all, prisons didn't begin, obviously, in America. America, 1607, 1619, so forth. It began many, many centuries ago. From the birth of modern civilization in the third millennial B.C. area, almost every major ancient civilization used some type of prison system to detain and remove personal freedoms of incarcerated people. I mean, it goes back to the basic question of the nature of the human being. Is the human being, is it not able to not do things that it shouldn't do? Well, obviously, no. There's their issue. People are going to cause problems. And so in those early periods of history, when you look back at those prisons back then, the early periods of history, they were often used as just kind of a temporary stopgap before sentencing people to something like death or life or even into enslavement. It was a chance to give you a chance. But anyway, as time went on and our civilization developed more, prisons started morphing into correctional facilities that started implementing the concept of rehabilitation and reform of prisons. Somebody came up with the idea that if I lock your butt up for 5 years, when you come out, you'll know how to act. Well, that's not a form of rehabilitation. In addition of holding convicted or suspected criminals, prisons were often used for holding political prisoners. That's another part. And enemies of the state and the prisoners of war. And that was what happened in Africa. And There would be conflicts among the birds and nations. They would capture the people, they would call them, they would put them in incarceration, put them into some kind of enslavement system, and use that. But again, that was not, it had limitations, and there were ways of getting out of it and so forth and so on, if you look at that history. So when we go back to places like Mesopotamia, Babylon, Kemet, prisons were always stationed at that point in what's called underground dungeons. They used to put all of the prisoners down in holes who were guilty or suspected criminals, spent their life either waiting death sentences or command to become, you know, in captivity. We found in Europe, Greece was one of the first ones. The Greeks had poorly isolated buildings that they used to use to lock people up. And the primary source of their detentions were not dungeons always, but big high walls or bars, sometimes just simple wooden blocks that were attached to their feet. And they had to walk around like that. There was also a system where you put them in these blocks where you put your hand and feet and leave you outside. And then the Romans came along. The Romans had a real cool system. They would take you in those deserted islands off, way off into the nowhere, a place like Patmos. You've all heard of the Patmos story. And so the Romans used that. But a lot of times what their captives had to do is they had to become soldiers. And so they end up turning a lot of theirs into gladiators. And so if you got out there and fought and did some of the things that, you know, that they wanted you to do under that system, then, you know, you might be able to work yourself off. Rome had a well-known to have armies of thousands of captives who were called slaves, and they were used for all different things in the Roman Empire. And then as civilization began to develop in Europe, the Magna Carta, for instance, when that was signed by King John, he passed a law, or they passed a law, that nobody could be in prison without first having a trial. That's the first place that came into existence. And even things like pardon and things like that began to develop along those lines. And then the French got involved. The French had some heavy, ugly prisons. And then the Russians. And so at that point, the modern prisons began to grow. They became cool. A lot of them were basically governmental things that were fighting at people who would disagree with the system, economics. In Europe, and particularly in England, if you owed money and owed somebody money and didn't pay them, you went to jail. They call it debtor's jail. Those were most of the people that ended up coming to America and settling in these colonies. They were people who had been arrested in debtor's jails, and they came over here to work this off. And so this history, and I can say just for the sake of time, I didn't go through it, it began long, long, long time ago. And it began in a way that we began, if you look at it, it grew and grew as the money and the economics began to develop. It got ugly. In America, the prison system in America was very interesting because the first prisons in America started like in the, started back in the 1700s. The first prison in America started in 1798 in Trenton, New Jersey. And it was a maximum security prison for men. But however, most of the people in there were Europeans because the Africans were in captivity. They were already in prison. So it wasn't them at that time. And they were basically there from people that had come over from Europe. And most of the people that were arrested, the second prison to open was a prison in New York called Auburn Correctional Facility. And Auburn started around 1817. And most of the prisoners that were in that prison were Irish and Italians because they were considered to be the out miscast. And as I said, the Africans were in captivity. So they had their own system for dealing with them, and they'd do anything because they were property, they just kill them. But the prisons in the 1817s were Italians, and they were Irish, were most of them. Auburn Correctional was the second prison to open in 1817. The third prison to open, at that time it was one of the largest ones, was Sing Sing in New York. Sing Sing Correctional Facility was built in 1825. It opened in 1828. It was a maximum security prison that sits off of the Hudson River. And as you know, at that time, the settlement of New York was the Dutch, which was Amsterdam. New Amsterdam is what it was called. And those prisons were real harsh. Sing Sing is, oh man, I don't even talk about it, the deal that was. The next prison was in 1829, was in Philadelphia. It was called the Eastern State Penitentiary. Most of the inhabitants in there were Quakers. A lot of the Quakers were arrested during in Philadelphia around that time. The man who where they believed in a religion, they weren't Quakers yet. But the man Fox, who started the Quaker religion, wrote his memoirs and wrote his the foundation of Quakerism, sitting in Eastern State Prison Penitentiary in the 1800s. The fifth one is the Missouri State Penitentiary, opened in 1836. Jefferson City, Missouri is where it was. And you see, the thing about Missouri, you're beginning to go into a more agricultural place, system. You know, that's where all of your, a lot of wheat and barley and stuff grew in Missouri. That's where you got the breweries down there, St. Louis, and in that area. And that was known as the gateway into the West, where that's where you began to get into the cowboy stuff then. And that was one of the reasons for that prison. But in looking at the, all of the summary of all of this history and looking at how it's understood, let me just give you some quick facts. And then we're going to take a break, and I'm going to open up and let you talk. Here's some quick facts about this prison system that we're talking about and why we have to talk about it. White Americans are 64% of the population of the United States. They are 39% of incarcerated population. That means for every 100,000 white Americans, 450 of them are in prison. The Hispanics are 16% of the U.S. population. They are 19% of an incarcerated population of the United States. That means for every 100,000 Hispanics, 831 of them are incarcerated out of 100,000. My brothers and sisters, our people, are 13% of the U.S. population. 40% now in 2010 are of the U.S. incarcerated population, which means for every 100,000 African Americans, 2,306 of them are incarcerated. Now, here's the deal. Why? That's the question. Why is it so many African Americans? And most of the response to that has been they commit more crime. They don't know how to act. They animals and all of the things that we've heard and that have been written about African people throughout the history of our existence in this country. That's the kind of stuff that we're dealing with. So even now, to come into the midst of it and begin to create a solution plan, you would have to attack that kind of information first. You would have to go at that in a very, very diligent way, because obviously, very clearly, we know that that's not the case. Some of the things that Caucasians, it's just that they don't get arrested for. One of the things I want to mention also that has happened now into the criminal justice system that people are now beginning to have to pay attention to, on top of the COVID and all of that's going on, there is now a new sexual culture that has begun to develop out of prison life. Because now women are higher numbers than they ever have been before. Black women More black women are being incarcerated now than ever before. And they're being incarcerated on things that are along the economic lines. A sister will grow in Walmart, and she needs to get her kids some stuff, and she'll write, at least at one point in time, she'll write some $250, $300. She'll write a check for $350, and knowing she got the fund, the check bounce, it's insufficient fund, they got so much time to pay it, she can't pay it, then it becomes a criminal offense, and then she's arrested. Because of the amount, over a certain amount, it's a felony. Going one of the department stores or one of the boutiques and steal a $500 sunglasses, designer glasses, get caught, get arrested, that's a felony. And so now she has to be arrested, and she doesn't have the proper thing to defend herself. She will then be incarcerated for a while. They will take her children, put them into the system, and then she will go to prison for maybe only a year and a half or a year or something like that. But when she gets out, she's going to have hell to pay to try to get those kids back. She's going to have to go through all kinds of stuff to try to get those children back. And what happens to those children in the foster care system? You know what the deal may be. But these are the things that make it necessary for us to continue to deal with this situation, to talk about it, to come up with the solutions. A lot of men are coming out of prison with AIDS, and they're coming back into homes and dealing with their mates, and they're not letting them know, or in some cases they don't know they have it. And the women are being infected with AIDS. And as a result of that, now the women are infected and they're dying. I know stories of people that have experienced that. There were some ugly stories about how people are housed in prison. That's another area of study and understanding that you have to begin to look at. And back out of those work camp days and things like that, there were stories where in order to keep the men from running away, they would be chained one to each other. And so if one runs, the other one got to run too. And if the other one is slow and can't move it, then, you know, there's going to be some challenges. There was a movie made years ago with Sidney Poitier called The Fired Ones. He and Tony Curtis were chained together in a chain gang, which was strange because most of the prisons were segregated. And so whites and blacks didn't come together. But even down in the lower, in Georgia, in the Georgia-Florida area, there were cases where the men were chained with women. Women who had been incarcerated were chained to men to stop the men from running away or fighting, so you would be chained together, and that would be a challenge for a man to try to run away with a woman chained to his arm. But the problem with that at nighttime, and what might have happened to that woman who's chained next to a man at night in a prison, and they both been there for 10 years, and what may occur in all of that. Those are the things that you have to look beyond. So that whole sex relationship system with incarcerated men is things that we have never looked at that is now beginning to come to light and causing all kinds of problems. And what happens, and how you put men in cells with men who are very feminine. And now with your transgender and some of those other areas, the LGBT community has had to come to the forefront and fight about that. You bring a transgender man into a prison, a male prison, and put him in the general population, buddy, it's horror, nightmare. And so I want us to think about that. And so when we come back, let's talk about this a little bit. Let's open up the lines and see what you think. What can we do? If you see anything that we can do to address, suggestions you might make, stories that you might know of, you know, let's talk about it, because I think this is what we must continue to do. One of the first programs I did here when I started broadcasting on the network is to talk about the prison, the school to pipeline prison scenario and what that meant. looking at that and some of the research that was done on that. So anyway, let's take a break, and we'll take a quick break, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to open up the lines, and I want to hear from my brothers and sisters on what we think about this incarceration system that we are living under, that's getting larger and larger every day, larger and larger.
What you are calling African history and Negro history are the missing pages of world history. Then he said, son, go study the history of your masters. Go study the history of the people who enslaved you and find out why they found it a necessity to remove an entire people from the respectful commentary of the history of the world. But my earliest impressions of them was a people in power who intended to stay in power, and I began to wonder why they had so much and other people had so little, and why everybody I knew worked harder than they. Who made this arrangement? I studied European history and world history. Now, when I went back to Schomburg with some knowledge of background of European history, now he began to show me how to study African history. Arthur Schomburg taught me the interrelationship of African history to world history. Willison Huggins of the Old Harlem History Club taught me the political meaning of history. And from the lectures of William Leo Hansberry of Howard University, I learned the philosophical meaning of history. The most valuable lesson I've learned is that when you address a people by their right name, that name must relate to land, history, and culture. All people go back to the geography of their original origin and identify themselves, no matter where they live on the face of the earth. We have overused the word black because black tells you how you look, but it don't tell you who you are. You can call an Italian white. That don't tell you anything about him. We are the only people who seem to have lost that all essential trait.
Time for an awakening media lineup. Monday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., African Perspectives, with host Brother Oshi, Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Same time, same place. Continued Monday lineup, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., Acres of Diamonds with host Brother Jihad Ahmed. 8 p.m. to 9 p.m. Black Therapy Central, host Dr. Mawia Kambon and Sister Nataki Kambon. 9 p.m. till 10 p.m. Conversation Reparations, first and third Mondays. On Tuesday, 8 p.m. till 10 p.m., Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers. On Thursday, 7 p.m. till 9 p.m., Melanin Live with host Lance Jones, co-host Boniswa Ayan. Fridays, 8 p.m. till 10 p.m., Time for an Awakening with creator of Time for an Awakening and host, Brother Elliot, co-hosted by Brother Richard. Saturday, 4 p.m. till 6 p.m., Black Sister Talk with host Wanda Chambers. 7 p.m. till 9 p.m., The Elders of Sankofa. And Sunday, 7 p.m. till 9 p.m., Time for an Awakening, host Brother Elliot and co-host Brother Richard. Check us out.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
We are back. Greetings, sisters and brothers. We are here back. We are talking about the carceral system in America and the emasculation of the black male, and I guess we needed to have added female as well. We are all suffering under this horrible, horrible system. So we're here tonight to talk about that. We're going to open up the lines. I just wanted to make note that for all of our listeners, one of the things that I've thought about doing is each day, you know, we have a wonderful legacy that's based on our music. Our music is a wonderful legacy for us as a people that has been an inspiration and a joy and a motivation for us through very tough and difficult times. So I thought maybe I would open up our program today. I opened up with a very powerful song from the great Horace Silver called Songs for My Father. And then we just heard recently the great Billie Holiday singing Take All of Me. And those are songs that have inspired us and motivated us and helped us through our struggles and the troubles of our time. So I wanted to do that as a way. I want to also make mention that on Thursday of this week, I want to talk about a possibility of a new program that's going to start. We have a young woman who is the executive director of the Chamber of Commerce of the Cameroon in West Africa. And she is going to be, hopefully, she's going to do a pilot program this Thursday at 6 o'clock right here on Time for an Awakening, Black Reality Think Tank. She's going to talk about how to trade with Africa. If you have a business or you wish to have a business or you wish to encounter with someone who has doing business in Africa, how it may be. She also is going to talk about her life in her process of repatriation back into Africa. She was basically born here in the States but decided to go to Africa and live. She met her husband who is from the Cameroon. And she is now going there and raised a family. So she's going to be talking this Thursday and answering questions. And she and I are going to kind of, as we say, chop it up a little bit about really the real life of Africa and what is it like right now from somebody that's there. And that's the way we want to approach that on Thursday. So I ask all of you, by all means, please listen. Her name is Sister Charmaine Pender. And she is going to be talking about her role as the executive director for the Chamber of Commerce. And their job is to try to get businesses here in America to trade with businesses in Africa. And you know that can be risky. As a rumor, but I don't think it's a rumor. I just say that cautiously because I don't have the evidence that took Ron Brown's life away based on that history. It silenced Brother Randall Robinson with the organization that he was running. That's a hot topic. So anyway, she's going to come on and see what happens, and we're going to talk about business and culture and working in Africa with people here in the States. So this Thursday at 6 p.m. Central Time, 7 p.m. Eastern, 5 o'clock Mountain, and 4 o'clock Pacific. So we ask you to please join us right here, 215-490-9832. And that is our call-in number for those of you who are listening via the Internet right now. If you'd like to call in and talk about this carceral system that we have been discussing, by all means, welcome you to do that. 215-490-9832. Okay. Brother Marcus, how you doing tonight?
Yes, Dr. Rogers, good evening. I'm doing great, brother.
Good. Thank you so much. What do you think? What are your remarks about the carceral system of America?
Yeah, well, you know, crime, you know, when I was growing up as a child, you know, my parents told me, oh, you know, son, crime doesn't pay. But as I got older, I realized that actually crime does pay because the judge get paid, the lawyer get paid, you got the police, you got the guard. So they create a whole industry from crime, you see. So crime is a necessity in America, you see. They have to have crime. Because, as you say, if there wasn't crime, a lot of these people would be on the cheese line. Right. So, but what they do, they create the conditions that cause the crime in our community. You see, when you're living off of 0.05% of the economy of America, you got to have crime. You know, they create the conditions. Mm-hmm. And I would go a little bit further. I would say the whole America is a prison for black people.
It is.
You know, I would take it to that extent because when you really examine the thing, you see that the food we eat, we don't grow the food.
Mm-hmm.
The clothes we wear, we don't make the clothes. And we have known these people have poisoned people out. They have used smallpox, even the Indian smallpox. The educational system miseducates us as African people.
Mm-hmm.
The health system, you know, we see what's going on with the healthcare system. You know, they benefit from all these things. They benefit from, and the police, he is the warden. See, so the whole thing, you know, it's just a circle. We keep going around in a circle in this country because, you know, and you know what I think, brother. It ain't no good. The whole system, you gotta kick it over.
Yeah.
You can't reform it. You know, I don't think you can really reform this system. It's like somebody said, you know, you have a cup of cyanide,
mm-hmm.
and then you pour half of the cyanide out, and then you're full. Fold it up with vitamins and nutrients, it's still poison. So that's what I think of America. America is poison for African people. And we are lucky to be alive. I tell you, when you really examine what we have been through, I don't know how the hell we make it so far. We are really phenomenal people. So, you know, that's my thoughts, brother.
Thank you so much, Brother Marcus. I tell you, that's right on the, you hit the nail on the head on that one. You're right on. Sister Ayan, what do you think about this carceral system? How is the system operating in Greensboro? Is it any different than the New Yorks and the Detroits and the LAs and the Milwaukees?
Well, I'm trying to hear you better. I hear a little static. So let me just try two different things. Microphone on and off. But anyway, first, greetings, everybody. And I really want us to, everybody that's listening, to share this program. Dr. Rogers taught us some very critical information. Part of why we stay in that circle that Brother Marcus just talked about, and Brother Marcus, thank you so much for what you shared, is because we're in denial about our situation. barbarians that control this country, we're in denial about the death of their sinister savagery. And so, when you break it down like that, as I was listening, all I could think of is that these are barbarians, you know, and there's no excuses, there's nothing else to say. These are barbarians. We are under the control of barbarians. I was feeling a lot. I went through a range of feelings, and I'll tell you why in a minute. But I got really angry, and then I felt depressed because like Brother Marcus was said, we keep going in the same circle.
Right.
Every century or epoch, as we talked about, Doc, that occurs, you have slavery by another name. That's what this is. This is neo-slavery, is slavery by another name. And we raise hell, we talk about it and whatnot, but it's getting worse. And but black folk, I can't include myself in this, black folk elected, and it still blows my mind, Biden and Harris, who are the mass incarceration administration.
Yes, they are.
How in the hell did black people do that? We're blind and stupid. Now my anger is going to come out. We're blind ass, stupid ass people to elect those two who are just going to further this carceral state. They're going to further it. They're going to maintain it. There's no way in the world that this thing should be growing the way that we've been fighting against this and trying to free political prisoners. I got to look at our dear brother, H. Rapp Brown. I can't remember his Muslim name. But I got to look at him. And he was talking from his cell. That man has been in solitary for 20-something years? He's been in. I don't know if Brother Bruce is on.
Yeah, he's on.
But
I'm gonna ask him to talk about it a little bit.
Yeah. I got to look at his face, and I've seen so many black men who've been in solitary for years, and they have the same look on their faces, and it's trauma, total trauma. One brother here in the South, he was locked up for 19 years on some lying ass charge. And when he was finally released, the man was so traumatized and was given his million whatever dollars, he killed himself.
Right.
You know, so this, and it traumatizes, as you were saying, Doc, it traumatizes the whole family and the whole community.
That's right.
So that's the piece I want us to focus on. This is not just somebody else's child or husband or whatever. This stuff traumatizes the whole community. The first, and I'm going to shut up in a minute, but the first time I saw it for myself, see, I was during the crack era, I was asked to speak at a prison, and I didn't know what I was stepping into. And so I walked into the prison, la-di-da, you know, talked to people, and all I saw was a whole ocean of black men in orange suits. And I almost fell out. I could not believe what I was seeing. And that's when the reality hit me. So, I'm so glad you're doing this, because we've got to face this reality. It's not going to change. Our only option is to go back to the motherland, because from my understanding, indigenous people in Africa did not have prisons. We dealt with things in more humane ways. And then, of course, the Caucasian comes in, and then things change up. But, yeah, we got to get out of here. That's my thing.
Well, that's
separation or die.
And that's what our sister on Thursday is going to talk a little bit about, what's the process of doing that in something like the Cameroon. But let me go. Brother White, I want to ask you, because I know you were in New York, lived in New York City, as well, and that's a huge police state. Do you remember Bruce White? Brother White? Herbie White?
Hello.
Hello, yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Yeah. Good evening, Dr. Rogers and everyone on the show. Yeah, I remember Judge Wright. I saw him speak. He spoke at the UAM that I was a member of, and I saw him speak at Simultap.
Right.
And whatnot. Yeah, he was very, very popular in the black community.
Very popular. Very popular. He was a good brother.
Yeah.
And he had a bunch of sons that also became lawyers and judges.
Okay.
I love Bruce Wright. I loved him.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I just wanted to see if you remember. Yep. Any comments, any additional comments you want to make about the carceral system?
Well, Europeans are parasites. Mm-hmm. They can't survive without feeding off of something, somebody else or something else. They need other people's blood, other people's lives. So they can't exist on their own. So what they're doing, they're never going to stop doing it because they can't survive if they do. They're never going to stop doing what they're doing. So like Brother Marcus said, or as Francis Quest Wilson put it in the nine people activities,
mm-hmm.
you know, anything you do, you're going to find the same European acting in the same way.
Right.
You know, he can't help himself because he cannot survive. He cannot create what he needs to survive. He has to get it from somebody else.
Right. That's right.
And we are the richest source.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
You can't get any better than African people. So mm-hmm. that's the richest source. So you're going to go to the richest source to get what you need.
Right.
So they're never going to stop doing what they're doing. I was arrested in New York. There was a scam that the transit police had. They had several scams, but a cop would lay down on the stairs like a homeless person, and he would lay a watch on the stairs next to
right.
whoever came by and picked it up.
Right.
They would jump up and arrest you and say that you took it out of his pocket.
I remember that.
Mm-hmm. You remember that? They had another team that would leave a wallet right by the phone booth, and if you picked that up, they would arrest you and say, you know...
Right.
And every which whatever item they use would cost more than $100, so that it would be grand larceny,
right.
not petty larceny.
Petty larceny, right. That's right.
And a lot of people went to jail behind that. They had other ones that would say that they saw you, touching a woman on the train and everything. The woman would say, nobody touched me, and they'd say, well, I saw it. And a lot of people, I was very fortunate that the judge dismissed my case. But, you know,
that's New York.
You didn't have to be doing nothing to go to jail.
Yeah, nothing at all. They stopped you from sitting. My wife was waiting for me to pick her up one day from work. She worked at a telephone company downtown in Lower Manhattan. And she was waiting outside for me, and the police pulled up and wanted to charge her with lottery for prostitution. Yeah, and at that time, I was working in law enforcement. What I did, they did not charge her, but it was really an embarrassment to her at that time. But yeah, you're right, Brother White. That's exactly right. Dr. Bridges, so you can get ready, I'm gonna come to you. I want you to talk a little bit about Amin, and some of where he is now. But I'm gonna go over here to Brother Timothy, see how he's doing. Brother Timothy, how you doing today?
I'm doing good, sir, and I heard you mention Eastern, you know, and
right.
I taught across
it's
the street
a museum
from a school.
Now, right?
Isn't
it a museum?
Yes, it is, sir.
Okay.
And I taught in my early years of teaching, I taught at a school called Starter Fleischer. It's right across the street from Eastern.
Mm.
And they every Halloween, they make it a site where you could come and dress up, and it's spooky, you know. And I said to myself, do the people really know the history of Eastern? You know, Slick Willie Sutton told him his way out of Eastern, and that's what the movie Shawshank Redemption got that theme of the tunneling out of the a prison, Eastern.
Right.
And I hope you know that Al Capone was there and a few other people. But let's get back to the brothers.
But let me ask you: is that the where Shawshank Redemption film was shot? Was that shot?
I don't think so.
No.
But the
okay.
idea of the tunneling out came from Eastern. And the guy Slick Willie Sutton, they freed him out of jail because they want to know how is it that you're able to get out of these places? You know, even pay them, you know, to get all the secrets and this knowledge. It's interesting how the system uses you one way and uses you the other. But in any event, let's go with the brothers and sisters, right?
Yeah.
You know, there's some people that go in prison and come out in a body bag. And then you have some people that come out and make a contribution to their people.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to say Malcolm X.
Yep.
You know, it wasn't for the books that the millionaire donated, Parkhurst. You know, Malcolm was a brilliant student in prison.
Mm-hmm.
Jeremiah Shabazz talked about once Malcolm was released and they met each other because they stayed with each other in Philadelphia and different other places. Jeremiah became a chief minister also in the South. He's back and forth from the South to, and also up here in the North. And he said he didn't realize how smart Malcolm was. And he said he studied everything. And that prison discipline, I'm going to say, people don't realize how prison disciplines some people. And what I mean by that, Malcolm got out of there. And because of Malcolm and George Jackson, they'll never have a library like that again.
Mm-hmm.
Those two men studied, they wrote, they read, they got information from other people, you see? So I'm also about to talk about Huey. It was amazing how Huey got out. But if you ever read Huey B. Newton's book, Revolutionary Suicide, which is a dissertation for his PhD, I don't know, a lot of people didn't know Huey B. Newton had a PhD. He talks about the prison system.
Right. Sure,
and fighting the system inside the prison and fighting the system on the outside. And of course, Angela Davis.
Right.
Who her and George Jackson were supposed to have been friends. On what level, I don't know. But in any event, because she has a different type of lifestyle.
Right.
So whatever it was back then, they had a relationship. And if you ever read George Jackson's Soul Dad Brother, you got to read him. You got to read his book, Soul Dad Brother, and you got to read, he wrote another book called Blood in My Eye.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to, see, some people don't let out, like Mumia, they don't want to let him out.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to let George Jackson out. So I just want to give you my spin on that some people are fortunate enough to discipline themselves and never go back. You got some people I know that are repeated felons.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, all the people who came before me gave a great presentation, man. Prison for us is different from prison than them. So you got two types of justices. You got a black justice and a white justice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's my piece.
All right. Thank you so much, my brother. That is exactly right. Does the nation still have that prison program? You know, because I remember at one point there was an actually concerted program where some of the brothers who were incarcerated in the penal system would work with brothers and help them to get out. Is that program still in operation?
It's probably not as strong as it used to be, brother. But
yeah.
People say to me, a lot of you Muslims, you learn Islam in jail. I said, you got to give Elijah Muhammad respect for having a prison ministry.
Right.
Because of his prison ministry, Christians had one.
Mm-hmm.
Jehovah's Witnesses had one.
Right.
He was the first one to start. He understood incarceration. You got to remember, he was the first conscientious rejecter in the nation.
Right.
Not Muhammad Ali. He was the first conscientious rejecter.
Mm.
That's important.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah,
that's
he was. He was. He definitely refused to fight. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Yeah.
They looked at him as a criminal. And you know, once it was destiny for him and Malcolm to hook up. See, once they hooked up, man, you know what I'm saying? That was heaven sent. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So once they hooked up, they could do it. But they looked at them as being, Muslims as being former incarcerated men and women. Hey, man, you like in prison in America, but don't look at it like it is. Elijah Muhammad was not a criminal.
Right.
There were people there. Listen, in movements, you got everything. In nations and movements, you got all kinds of people.
Right.
PhDs, you got lawyers, doctors, you have criminals, you got everything. Cooks, electricians, that's what you have in a nation.
Okay. All right. Beautiful. Thank you so much, Brother Timothy. I appreciate it.
Yes, indeed.
Reverend Lewis, are you there, Reverend Lewis? Reverend Lewis, are you there? Reverend Greg Lewis? Okay, Reverend Lewis. Back about maybe about 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, we invited a brother by the name of Dan Fodio. He was an attorney from Atlanta, and he was representing Salim Alameen, what's his first name? Dr. Bridges. What's his H. Rep Brown's first Muslim name? Dr. Bridges?
It's Jamil. Dr. Raz. I think it's Jamil.
Jamil Alameen. That's right. Dr. Bridges, are you there?
Right there.
You might have his phone on. Dr. Bridges, you got your phone on mute? Dr. Bridges? Okay, he's not around right this minute. But anyway, okay, we had invited Dan Polio, Brother Dan Polio, to come on and to talk about the prisoners, people who were arrested, and they were political prisoners, and what that process was like. That was a very interesting dialogue. He could not speak about the case of Jamil Alameen, but he did talk about the whole movement to free political prisoners. And there are still a lot of them right now in the penal institutions of America, and a lot of them are former Panther members and some other groups who were very radical, and they are there because of their politics and nothing more. So I wanted Dr. Bridges to talk about that because he had some direct involvement with that. And he's, like I'm saying, Dr. Bridges, are you back? Okay. All right. Let me go over to, see, I know Brother Griffin, you often have a lot of conversation about the penal system. From previously, I remember you talking about it. Do you want to say anything about it now, or are you just going to listen for right now, Brother Griffin? Brother Griffin?
Just listening.
Brother Griffin, you want to say something about the system?
I'm not sure why it's not coming in, but I'm listening to you.
Yeah, okay. All right. Any comments you want to make?
No, sir. Just listening.
All right.
Very informative, though.
Very good. Okay. Dr. Bridges, I see Dr. Bridges. He went on, came off, went on, came off. Brother Lush, how you doing tonight?
Hey, good evening. I'm been multitasking as you were talking. One question to you, Dr. Rogers. Uh-huh. Do you have any information of what it was like to be imprisoned in Africa, in the development and civilizations of Africa?
No, but I know that most of that was conflict, tribal wars, were situations where you saw and had began to see that emerge, because basically, unfortunately, in these wars, and hold it just a minute, Dr. Bridges, I see you, so just hold on, don't hang up now.
I've been here all the while.
But I couldn't hear, I was calling you and you couldn't hear me, I guess I kept calling you. But anyway, Brother Lush, I think there's some things that I've read that a lot of this was tribal conflict, because things that were based on the family and where there might have been problems with somebody stealing something or messing with somebody's wife, that they had another system to punish you for that. And so it was not a need to incarcerate you and lock you up. But when the tribal wars came forth, and even that was not what we think we see today. Those were conflicts that had a lot to do with, based on just complete warfare. And they could merge into,
okay.
merge into the system.
Okay.
They could marry, things like that.
All right. Real quick, because, you know, I really think that punishment had really, really been a confusing mark for everyone, especially as I'm going to go from biblical, and I won't be very long because I like to hear what Brother Bridges has to say too. You know, when Cain killed Abel, the only thing that he had was a light that had been shown upon him for the rest of his life.
Okay.
If that's punishment coming from the great creator, then, you know what, I guess it really would be cruel and unusual punishment, especially if we considered if someone murdered another person, that their bodies be taped and either taped or roped onto them face to face for the rest of their life. Mm. And that send a message to whomever else would ever decide they would want to murder someone, mm-hmm. that this is the kind of punishment that you're going to suffer because of the actions that you have taken against another life. Mm-hmm. So this conversation could go on and on. Yes. I'm going to stop there. We'd love to hear what Dr. Bridges has to say, but these are kind of some of my ideas in my way of thinking about things when we talk about punishment. Okay. Thank you so very much.
Well, thank you. Have you read the book Crime and Punishment?
No.
Okay, that's an interesting piece as well, even though it's written by a Russian, Sobinsky, I think his name was. But he gets into some of what you just mentioned in that book. Okay, Dr. Bridges, okay. Let's talk a little bit about political prisoners. Well, first of all, you want to respond to Brother Lush's comment? You got any thoughts on what he was asking?
No, not really, but I did want to respond to what you just mentioned about Jamil Elamine. And I could hear you, and I was talking back to you. I don't know what happened, so I got on another phone to call you back.
Yeah, I couldn't hear you, and it didn't come through at all. Okay. Uh-huh.
Yeah, but I could hear you real good.
Okay.
But I did notice that one thing, before I get to African-American prisons or the penal system, and that is that in Africa, black-on-black crime is terrible. When African men and women go into prison, as I witnessed when I was in West Africa, in Togo, Benin, also in Nigeria, and even when I was in Zimbabwe in South Africa, African men and women are treated terribly in prisons by other African men and women. And that happens because we have to realize that after colonialism, when Europeans went to Africa in the 14th and 15th century and taught Africans to begin to hate themselves, or for us to hate ourselves. I don't like to say themselves for Africans, and we sometimes will say them, but it's really us. How we were taught to hate ourselves, and that hatred that was self-bred into African men and women for themselves on the African continent, we hate ourselves and will actually exhibit that hatred worse sometimes in white people. I'll never forget, I was traveling in Africa, and I was with a group of people, and one of our security had to stop and chastise a driver who did something wrong in terms of our caravan. But Bill, he got our security got out of his vehicle, went to the other vehicle, took his rifle, and beat the man, tremendously over and over his head. I'd never seen anything like that. African people, and we have to accept and be willing to accept the truth, African people have been taught to hate themselves worse than anything in this world. And Amos Wilson talks about it when he says, black on black crime in the presence of white domination. So when you see black communities being chastised and corrupted by other black men and women, black on black crime, it's really because those black individuals have taken on the minds of white people. We hate ourselves. We hate each other. Some of us don't like to hear this, but we actually hate each other, and we hate each other because we were taught to hate each other.
Right.
And that self-hatred, as Honorable Elijah Muhammad used to say, that self-hatred was bred into the black man and the black woman in colonialism in Africa and on the plantations of this country. The lighter-skinned black man or woman hates the darker-skinned black man or woman. The darker-skinned black man or woman is jealous of the lighter-skinned black man and woman. We don't like to deal with this.
That's right.
But we as people, if we're ever going to develop and to correct ourselves and to improve ourselves, we have to begin to accept the kinds of things that we do to each other. And I know we do it, and I know why, but we're just the victims of what white people have taught us.
Okay.
And it's really, it's terrible. I get very incensed about it because when I saw this black man beat this other black man, I mean, it was something terrible. And we've seen it, too, in the black community, the black-on-black crime. But as Amos Wilson said, I want to say, it's not really black-on-black crime. It's really white-on-black crime because that black man or black woman has a mind of his enslaver. He has the mind of his captor. So he's out of his mind. So until he can recapture his mind and love himself and begin to love his own people, this will continue. And we have to understand that. And when we look at prisons in this country, you look at Elijah Muhammad, Malcolm X, Huey Newton, Eldridge Cleaver. You look at Stokely Carmichael, Jameel Al-Amin, as you mentioned. I want to talk about him, and H-Rap Brown. These are people who are the victims of a system, but who have not done anything. As a matter of fact, when a black man or a black woman gets through America and does not have to go to jail, that's something to be applauded. It's really something that we're not doing when we don't go to jail, because just about anything that you do for the upliftment of your people will actually cause you to become incarcerated in this system. When we really stand up and to fight for our people, to speak out for our people, and to do what we need to do in the system, we're going to put ourselves in a position to be arrested and to be killed in this system. I mean, we have to understand that. And I will never forget one good thing about being about incarceration, as Brother Timothy said. When you look at the African-American penal system, when I was teaching at St. Augustine's College in Raleigh, North Carolina, in about 1984, 1985. But every Saturday, Dr. Rogers, I never told you this, but I would go to Central Prison in Raleigh with Minister Kenneth X, who eventually became Kenneth Muhammad, and I would speak on the minimum in the minimum security prison. I would go to the women's prison. Then after I left the minimum security prison for the men, I would go to the medium, and then I would go to the maximum. And I used to speak on death row in Central Prison in Raleigh every week in 1984 and 1985 on Saturday. And the most intelligent, the most well-read people that I have ever met in my life are not the brothers and sisters who go to NCCU, who go to A&T, who go to Cheney State in Philadelphia, or who go to Wiley College or Rust College in Mississippi. But the most intelligent people are those brothers and sisters who read and study in prison, because they have time and they really read, and they become critically analytical about the system, and they come out, and that's what happened to Malcolm. He began to use what he learned in prison to transform the lives of many African people in our communities. Same thing with Huey P. Newton. He did the same thing. Jameel El-Amin. He's been to jail many times. And by the way, I haven't heard too much on him lately, but the last thing I heard was that his people, some of the people in his organization called IJAN, called the Imam Jameel El-Amin Network, shortened for IJAN, they're trying to still do what they can to release him. And as you know, Mumia Abu-Jamal is still in prison, and his health is not good. I understand somebody might want to call in to mention it. He has COVID right now. From what I understand, Mumia Abu-Jamal has COVID right now. And, of course, then you got Matula Shakur of the BLA, who's still incarcerated, and Jameel El-Amin. His health is not good, you see. So one of the techniques and tactics of the system of white people and other enslavers is to take organizers, intelligent people. Because when you think about it, the people who go to jail are not ignorant people. These are very intelligent people who go to jail. And that's because they see the system for what it is, and they want to do something about it. But when you don't understand the system and you stand up for the Star Spangled Banner, you pledge allegiance to the flag, you go to church every Sunday, and you look at the American flag in your church, and then you don't think that you need to do anything. But when you begin to critically analyze the system in which we live, then you are likely to go to jail in this society because you see it for what it is and you want to do something about it. So it's a whole different situation. And when we look at the history of prisons, you mentioned it before, when you look at the history of prisons, America itself was actually started by, created and initiated this whole system by the prisoners of England, who had been prisoners who had been let out of the jails of England to come over to America to start this system in America. You talked a little bit about it in your talk earlier, didn't you?
Yep, you did.
And the same thing with Australia. Australia is a penal colony of England. The Queen of England let those prisoners out of jail in England, said, y'all getting out of here, causing too much trouble. Go somewhere. They put them on a boat, took them over to Australia. Captain Cook and the people went to Australia and found the Aborigine people there, the darker-skinned people. And then it was a penal colony, and they were criminals who started that system in Australia, and these were criminals who started the United States of America. So a thief taught the black man and black woman to steal in America. A murderer taught the black woman to murder in America. The only reason we murder is because a murderer taught us. Who murdered us any more than white people who brought us here? So anything that you see us doing today is a direct offshoot of what white people were doing to us and what they were doing to each other before they came here, you see. So we have to stop blaming the victim and look at who the real culprit is in this whole conversation of prisons. Most of the people in this country up in Washington, D.C., the congressmen and senators, most of them, Cuomo, they need to be in prison.
Right. Exactly. Thank you. Very good. Thank you so much, Dr. Bridges. And you're right. You made some excellent points. When you go back and you look at that history, as you said, here in America, you'll see the same things, the same ideologies carrying forth. Mississippi has done a wonderful job through their tourism system of erasing out the fact that the original area that we know as Mississippi was originally a prison.
And it was right.
It was used to bring the immigrants and arrest them when they did things because of their hotness and the Delta Mississippi River. They couldn't run away. And so Mississippi was used as a prison camp, just like Florida was, down in the Everglades. The Everglades was a prison. And Native Americans were usually taken there and were forced to live down in that area. That's the whole history of reservations. And you look up
when we talk about crime in this country, and when black people want to chastise other black people doing something, I'm not talking about against other black people, because that's right. That's right. They should be chastised. But when black folk want to chastise other black folk about doing something against white people in this country, they can just throw that mess on out the wall. Throw that mess on out the window. Because if we wouldn't even be having this discussion about criminals and about prisoners and about stealing if white people hadn't stole us and brought us over here. The mere fact that we are here, a thief brought us here, stole us and took us from our native land and country, stole our religion, stole our spirituality. So when somebody talks to me about going through a self-checkout then picking up one or two things, no, you need to look at who it is that brought you here and why it is you're in this situation from the beginning. If you look at Lerone Bennett's book, Before the Mayflower, he has a section in the book the chapter on plantation about the difference that the slaves saw between stealing and between taking. It's not the same when you look at what black people do to white people as to what black people do to other black people. There's a difference. But most of us, because of the way that we've been taught in this system, we begin to analyze a situation that a black person does to a white person in the same way that a black person does something to a black person. But believe me, brothers and sisters who are tuned in, it's entirely different.
Right.
We would not be having this discussion if we were not taking prisoners and put on ships and brought across the Atlantic Ocean to the United States of America.
Right.
We're brought here. We're discussed it here because we're prisoners of war. We're prisoners of war. That's why we're discussing it. We lost the war.
Right. Let me go over here to Philadelphia number 484-423. Are you desiring to say something, or are you just listening, caller? 484-423. Just listening? Okay, that's fine. Get move forward. Sister Dee Dee, how you doing tonight, sister?
I'm doing fine, Doc Rogers, and hello, family.
Good. Hello.
I'm just listening, and I'm really enjoying it.
Okay.
So very interested. I mean, it's so interesting, so important. Very, very good show, Doc. And the guests are, I mean, Doc Bridges, everyone, man, just awesome.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Appreciate it, and because we are. And that's basically, as everyone has said, we have to continue this discussion. We have to keep talking about it in ways that can obviously pull forward some way to improve, or to, Brother Marcus said, get rid of it, because it's not going to improve. You're not going to reform the criminal justice system. I do not believe that. I may be wrong, but I will say I do not believe that you will reform the criminal justice system. There's no such thing as that. And it's designed to do some things, as I read earlier from Waymus Wilson's book, and what it was doing. It's linked to economics, and you're not going to be able to cut that off in the way. There's an excellent book also that's kind of new I wanted to call your attention to. It's a book by Ernest McMillan. He was the co-founder of SNCC in Dallas, and he's been a very strong activist for the incarcerated. He wrote a book called We Are Not Slaves. And he said in the book, his idea is that the prison system is a microcosm of concentration of what is actually in the whole of society. And that's what most of our comments have been tonight. Brother Marcus talked about it. Dr. Bridges just mentioned that. What you look at, when you look at the carceral system, you are looking at life in America for black people. We are limited where we can go. You're limited what you can say. You're limited what you can do. And as Dr. Bridges said, we are prisoners of war. This is a war.
Dr. Rogers.
Yes, ma'am. Go ahead. Go right ahead.
Okay, thank you. I don't know if you mentioned this early on, because there's a few minutes in the beginning that I missed, but the Ferguson uprising, a lot of that was about our black men and women being arrested for pretty much nothing. Pretty much nothing. Exactly. And they broke down, like you did, some of what I heard, they didn't break laws, but they just, you know, the police and the so-called justice system just created laws so they could arrest these young black men, mm-hmm. thousands, that's locked right. up for nothing. And so let's not, you know, have it in our minds that every black person that's in prison committed a crime. There's so many that are innocent. The Innocence Project has been one organization that has been responsible for a lot of brothers and sisters coming out of prison who've been unjustly in prison for years. And the other thing I heard, one of the latest stats is that might have been from Sean King, who's also doing a whole lot of work on exposing the incarceration system, but that every black man that's in prison, let me back up. Black men that are on the streets in the hood are worth nothing to this society.
Mm-hmm.
But when they're locked up, they are worth $40,000 a day.
Mm-hmm.
To this mm-hmm. government.
That's right.
So yeah. There is a great economic benefit for this neo-slavery, which is, I'm going to repeat, is horribly barbaric.
Yeah,
I've heard women talk about, you know, how it feels to have people in prison, and we've just got to be able to relate to this emotionally so that maybe, not maybe, so we can look at this, dealing with this in some different ways, because it's unacceptable.
Yeah. And you see,
you can't change it like you're saying.
Right. And see, the thing is, like you said, you made a very good point. And when you think about it like that, how the economics is attached to the incarceration system, you know, it becomes very clear. inmates have to have toilet paper.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody sells that toilet paper to the prison system. So if you got a prison with thousands of people, the people got to buy toilet paper. They got to buy soap. They got to buy food. regardless of the quality of it, it still has to be purchased. There's so many things of that nature that go along with running that institution. So if you really want to see an example, if you can look at your state budget and how much money they spend on prisons and incarceration, it would become clear, because somebody is getting that money.
That's right.
And that money is going to those that are Colgate, the prison labor. I understand, what was it, the Victoria's Secrets at one time?
Using
prison labor and so forth. So it's really an economic entity. That's why it's not going to change. Brother Timothy, you got 2 minutes.
I'm going to say this, sir. Bill Cosby is in a prison on the outside of Philadelphia. And I wasn't there. I don't know anything about those women. And I'm not about men raping no women. But I'm going to say this. He settled a case. They found a way to open it back up to lock him up. I'm going to say this to you. O.J. Simpson, I'm not fond of him at all. But when he got off on the criminal, they got him on the civil. I think that when it comes to our people and we successful, if they don't like you, they find a way to lock you up, black women and black men.
No doubt about it. Well, my
brothers, I just had to add that.
My sisters and brothers, it has come to that bewitching hour.
And just remember,
close it out, Dr. Bridges. I'm sorry.
I apologize. I just wanted to say that one thing that we need to remember.
I got to close it out.
Okay, I thought you said you wanted me to. Okay, go ahead. Okay, uh-huh.
Thank you so much, ladies and gentlemen. We appreciate it. And we'll be back here next Tuesday. Don't forget Thursday at 6 o'clock. We're going to have the young lady from the continent that will be talking. Have a wonderful week, and we'll see you back here Tuesday or we'll hear you Thursday. Take care.
Nobody knows all the trouble I've seen. Nobody knows but Jesus. Nobody knows all the trouble I've seen. Lots of trouble float around these days. Seems like everybody's sick. And I'm right in there with them. Well, there's one thing that's for sure. Ain't no use crying. Just get in there and pitch. Sometimes you need help. That's when you kind of look up, you know. That's Sometimes I'm up, sometimes I'm down.
Don't hear me.
Oh, yes, my Lord.
Sometimes I'm almost to the ground.
Don't hear me.
Yes, my Lord.
Pray, don't need
help. Although you see me going long, so
don't hear me.
Oh, yes, my Lord.
Yes, I have my trials here down when below. Everybody's always singing the blues about his own troubles. And the thing to do is to get with the big boss. That's right. Look up sometimes. Nobody knows the trouble I've seen. And I ain't gonna bug nobody about it either. I know where I can get help when I need it. Yes, sir. Every time. Maybe you'd better try it.